a bit of a postscript on Perek Daled, which, and I promised we would start Perek Perek Hay today. But I think it's valuable. I think it's worthwhile taking a rewind just a little bit. There's another anachronistic word. And going back to the story of the birth of Ikavod and the death of Eshet Pinchas, because the parallel to the death of Rachel and the birth of Binyamin is so striking that it's worth really spending a few moments looking at. Did I give you a source page? It's marked Shmuel Perek Daled Galuta Aron Chorban Shiloh 66-67. Yeah. Okay. Yep. Very good. Yes. Absolutely. We have many more. So.
Anyone else? Anyone else?
So we looked at the story of the birth of Ikavod from the perspective of the legacy issues from the first part of the Sefer, namely that just as we saw in the case of Eli, a kind of perversion of priorities and perspectives and the overemphasis on the relationship to God versus the relationship to man. We saw it in Pinchas and Chofni and Pinchas as well. When the story is relayed to us about the death of the sequence of events that took place in the battle, going back to Pasuk Yud Bet, Perek Daled, Pasuk Yud Bet, Vayarotz ish binyamin me'amaracha v'yavosh shiloh b'yom ahu. A binyaminite comes running from the battle to the maracha, from the battle comes to Shiloh, torn clothes and dirt on his head, whether it's a sign of the battle or as a sign of mourning, either way. And he relates to Eli the sequence of events. We talked about the emphasis that ultimately, with all of the tragedy that took place, the battle and the war and the deaths of so many Israelites, and then the death of Chofni Pinchas, and ultimately the capture of the Aron. Eli's response to the capture of the Aron is ultimately what is so graphically described. And he hears about it, he's in shock, he falls off his chair, and he dies. And then we have a similar reflection in the description of the birth of the son, the child, to Eshet Pinchas. We had a machloket between the shir as we presented it and the presentation in the footnote in the art scroll perush on Sefer Shmuel, as to whether or not that reflected a positive value in the case of Eshet Pinchas or a negative value, but clearly she also places the emphasis on the capture of the Aron. They try to appease her with the fact that this is a child, a son is a kind of continuity for Chofni and Pinchas, and she names this son Ikavod because Gala Kavod Mi'Israel, the glory of Israel, has been taken, has been captured, Nilkach Aron Elokim. And it reflects a kind of overemphasis or perversion of values in the face of death that places more emphasis on the material object, on the ritual context of the object, the Aron, and all of its significance against the value of human life, the value of relationships between people. And I think that that's a theme that carries through many components of Tanakh, and with the greatest respect to the interpretation that is reflected there, I would argue that that actually it's a critical indictment of Eshet Pinchas. If we look at these psukim specifically in the story of the death of Eshet Pinchas, we mentioned this last week, I think, if I'm not mistaken, or was it last week? Yeah, last week. The parallel to the story of Rachel and the death of Rachel at the time of the birth of Binyamin, I think, is very striking, and I don't think it's an accident. I think it's very very intentional. Take a look at starting with Pasuk Yud Tet. V'chalato Eshet Pinchas Haralalat, his daughter-in-law, Pinchas's wife, began to was pregnant to give birth. Lalat is a short form of laledet. V'tishmat Hashmua li lakach Aron Elokim umet chameh v'isha. She hears the news about about the capture of the Aaron and the death of her father-in-law and husband. She goes into premature labor. She crouches down as if on the birthing stool, and she goes into labor. Ucheet muta. She's dying. Clearly, right? Her pain is such that this is going to cost her life. Ukeet muta, as she is dying, vatdaberna hanitzavot aleha, those women standing around her say to her, al tir'i kiven yaladet, don't be afraid, because you are birthing a son. Velo anta, she did not answer. Veloshata liba, nor was her heart quieted, comforted. Vatikrala na'ar, ikavod. She names the child, and she names him ikavod. Ikavod meaning?
No honor.
Right? The lack of honor, the absence of honor, or the absence of glory is probably a better term. Lemor, gala kavod miYisrael. Reflecting the kavod of Israel that had gone into exile. What is the kavod of Israel that has gone into exile? So now the question is, what kavod, what glory of Israel is she referring to? El hilakach arone elokim ve'el chameh ve'isha. The capture of the ark and of God and the death of her father-in-law and husband. What is the glory of Israel? Is it the Aron, or is it her father-in-law and husband, the Kohen Gadol and the Kohen? Vatomer, gala kavod miYisrael, ki nilkach Aron Elokim. The glory of Israel has gone into exile, the ark has been captured, gala kavod miYisrael, she names the child Ikavod. Not an accident, the parallel to the story of Rachel is striking. Not only is it a parallel in terms of the context, namely, what's similar, what observations stand out as similar components of the story? Obvious ones.
The death of the mother, right? At the time of the
birth. Woman who dies in childbirth. Excuse me?
Don't worry, you're having a son.
Don't worry, the comforting women, don't worry, you're having a son.
The name of the child that the mother gives is a name that isn't a happy name, so to speak.
Right? The sadness.
She calls him Ben Oni. Correct. She calls him Ikavod. They're both kind of downers.
Reflecting the tragedy of the context of the story, the name is included in the story itself. Correct? Now, all of these are correct. All of these stand out. And, of course, the notion that somehow the death of the mother and the destiny of this child is significant as a contrast to what is happening. So I wanted to share this with you and go through a couple of observations about the story of Rachel that I think in both ways. Right? The story of Rachel sheds light on the story of Eshet Pinchas, and the story of Eshet Pinchas perhaps can help shed light on the story of Rachel as well. So pass these out. What you have at the top of this page are the two episodes side by side. Rather than flipping through Tanakh and then identifying all the parallels, I sort of shortcutted. Is that a word? Shortcutted? Is that a verb?
Like tape recorded.
Right, tape recorded. Shorted cut. I don't know how to do that. Okay, shortcut the process. On the right-hand side, you have the psukim that we just read. On the left-hand side are the psukim describing the death of Rachel. Get to the context of the story in a moment, but for now, just the story itself. Vayisumi bet el, vahi od kivrat haaretz lavo Ephrata. They're traveling from Beit El. If you remember, as Yaakov returns from Laban's house, just to recap the story, Yaakov is returning from Laban's house, meets up with Laban. There's a whole episode about the Trafim we'll come back to in a moment. After they separate, Yaakov goes to Shechem, episode of Dina in Shechem. Post the episode of Dina in Shechem, God comes to him and says to him, okay, it's time to move on to Beit El. At that point, there's a little dialogue about how he turns to his family and he tells them to remove the Elohei Nechar, all of the false gods, all of the idols amongst them. Hesiu Elohei Nechar Shebekibachem. I'll talk about that in a moment. And then they move from Beit El southward. As they're traveling, Vayisumi Beit El, they're traveling from Beit El southward towards Hebron, but Vayi od Kivat Haaretz Lavo Ephrata, there's still a Kivat Haaretz, whatever Kivat Haaretz means, to get to Ephrat, Vateled Rachel Vatikash Bilidita. Rachel begins to go into labor, albeit whether it be premature labor or the difficulty of the journey and the pregnancy, what other circumstances are, she clearly feels Vayi Behakshota Bilidita, that this labor is not going well, and it will, in the end, she will sacrifice her life to keep this child alive. Vatomer laha mialedet, the midwife says to her, "Al tiri ki gam ze lach ben, don't be afraid. This too is a son." Vayibetzet nafsha kimeta, as her soul was departing, she was dying. Vatikrashmo ben oni. She names the child ben oni. Ve'aviv karala binyamin. Father renames the son binyamin. Vatamot racha v'tekaveh b'derech Ephrata hi bet lachem, and she is buried along the way. The connection between these two stories is not our first to notice. Already the Medrash points out that there are three examples or three instances of a woman who dies in the context of or had challenged or difficulty giving birth. Vateled Rachel vatakash b'lidata. Shlosha hen shenitkashu b'shat lidatan umetu kishen chayot, died in childbirth. And they are Rachel, Eshet Pinchas. And the third one is a story into itself that we will come back to in the future study of Sefer Shmuel. The third one is Michal Bat Shaul. That's based on a medrash, less on text. We'll come back to it another time. But certainly the connection between Rachel and Eshet Pinchas is an obvious one. The medrash picks up on the external context, meaning two examples of women who died in childbirth. When you look at the two stories, suddenly you find that there are many more components of this parallel. Just to recap, how many parallels in text have we identified? A birthing woman who gives birth to a child and dies in childbirth. Standing at that moment around her are women present either as midwives or as neighbors, etc. who play a role, by the way, in the story of the naming of this child. Correct? Right, there's a whole conversation going on about the naming of this child. But in the case of Eshe ben Chasve, tikvala nar ikavod, leimor kara kavod mi Yisrael. It almost sounds like there's a dialogue going on, right? Back and forth. She says, "I kavod." They say, "Why? What's the kavod?" Well, there's a clarification. She answers, "Vatomer." There's parts of this dialogue going on. In the case of Rachel, she names this son Ben Oni. It's unclear when this child is renamed, but it is renamed by Yaakov. There's one other story where you have women present at the childbirth who were involved in the naming of a child, but I'm going to leave that for now. That's the end of Rut. We'll leave that for a different time. The name, as Bob, somebody mentioned the tragedy, or you named Alan, did you mention it? The tragedy reflected in the name, the notion that the Ben Oni, right, the pain, the tragedy, Ben Ikavod. There's two other subtleties in this parallel. Who is the birth? Who does Rachel give birth to? Right, what is it? Who's the child that Rachel gives birth to? Binyamin. Who is the mivaser? Who is the bearer of the tidings that brings about of this whole tragedy?
It's refugees from Binyamin.
A refugee from Binyamin. Ish Binyamin. Bayarot's Ish Binyamin me'amarecha. From the perspective of the story, it's irrelevant that he's from Binyamin. But from the perspective of the parallel, the fact that sort of this remnant of Binyamin conveys the message, I think, is very significant. And that all of this really brings us to the most important component of the story, which is what is the driving force behind the death of Eshet Pinchas, and what is the driving force behind the death of Rachel? What is it that brought about the death of Rachel? What is it that brought about the death of Eshet Pinchas? And really, all of these parallels, anytime you have a textual parallel in Tanakh, there's always an underlining message. It's not an arbitrary, or I have two stories that have the same theme, or have a similar sounding event. There's a fundamental focus or message being conveyed. In the case of Eshe Pinchas, it's easy. What's the fundamental issue that's driving the death of Eshe Pinchas?
The bad news about her husband and father-in-law.
The bad news, the corruption. Ultimately, it all comes down to why is she naming Yikavod? Because the Aron was captured. Why was the Aron captured? Because they took the Aron out of the Aron out of the Mishkan in the first place. And it was to come back to the fact that this Aron was taken into battle where it should not have been. And the tragedy that was brought about because of the taking of the Aron out of the Mishkan into a place where it should not have been. Which raises the question, what was the underlining issue in the death of Rachel? And so I want to segue for a minute into the story of Rachel and Sefer Bereishit and the naming of the child, Binyamin, on Yaakov's part. We've discussed before, but Rachel names him Ben Oni. Let's take a quick segue into Sefer Bereishit. We'll come back once I have. Where are we up to? Let's see. Lamed Hey. Lamed Hey is. Lamed Hey is the parak of that records the death of Rachel. When she names him Ben Oni, what does the word Ben Oni mean? Let's start with that. Pasuk Yudchet. Vahi betzet nafsha. Perek Lamed Hey, Pasuk Yudchet. Vahi betzet nafsha ki meta. So her soul was departing as she was dying. Vatikrashmo Ben Oni. What does the word Ben Oni mean? So here, I'll turn your attention to the source page that I just gave you. Okay. So beneath the chart is a bunch of sources. So Rashi, for example, translates Ben Oni as the word Ben Tsa'ari, the son of my pain or affliction, Tsa'ar. Ibn Ezra similarly talks about Ben Oni as Ben Evli, my evil, my sorrow, my mourning. V'chein kelechem onim, bread of mourning. Or, as in the case of the Pasuk, lo achalti ba'onim imenu. An onen. What's an onen? It's a stage of mourning between death and burial, halachically, but it's a stage of mourning. Onen, avel, right? These are components of the mourning process, or stages of the mourning process. And so the first, most intense part of that mourning process is the moment of death, where the survivors are called Onen. So she names this child Ben Oni, the son of my death, the son of my mourning, the son of my pain. Right? Ben Oni, lo achalti be'oni mimeno. I did not eat this kochim in the context of Avidu Maaser. The farmer has to declare that he did not eat this kachim, this food, in a state of mourning or in violation of the halacha. Lo achalti be'oni mimeni. The problem with the suggestion that Ben Oni somehow is related to her pain, her affliction, her death, the mourning over her death, is that it's a kind of almost a sense of a kvetch over her suffering. Why is she named this child Ben Oni? Because I suffered so much. I'm dying. I mean, this child was the cause of my death. It's kind of a stigma of a name. It's one thing to talk about a name that is tragic because it reflected a tragic occasion like Yikavod. It's another thing altogether to say that you're going to name this child the cause of my death, or the son of my death. Like, what is? It's a hard context to understand. This is another suggestion that somehow the story of Binyamin is related to not the word Aven with an Aleph, but just to play on the word for a moment, the word Aven with an Ayin. Aven with an Aleph is sometimes used in the context of Aven with an Ayin. We'll see later in the story there's a whole episode of a place called the Beit Aven with an Aleph. But the notion of Aven as a word, besides the Onen context of it, where the Vav is a vowel, Aven with the Vav is a consonant, is used in the context of a synonym for falsehood, lies, something which is unsubstantiated, like Avodah Zarah, like Dvar Sheker. I'll give you two examples. I have those examples on the source page for you, just to save us a little bit of time. Take a look at source 5 first. We'll come back to source 4 in a moment. In source 5, Pasuk in Zechariah, Ki hatrafim dibru aven, v'akosmim chazu sheker, v'chalomot hashav yidaberu Hevel yinachamun al kein nasu k'motzon ya'anu ki en roeh. Trafim dibu aven. Trafim are kind of these forms of idols used for sort of soothsaying guesswork of sorts. We'll come back to that in a moment. They spoke aven. Hakosmim, the, what's a kosem?
Magicians.
Sorcerers, magicians. They saw visions of falsehood, sheker. Mechalamot hashav yedaberu, and they speak of false dreams. Helvi nachamun, they bring false comfort. The synonym in all of these four phrases is sheker, shav, hevel, aven. All things that are vanity, that are falsehood, that are, and all associated with, by the way, all associated with idol worship, things that are prohibited, worshiping of soothsaying and magicians, things that the Torah explicitly forbids in the context of nichush, of the using of soothsayers and necromancers and sukkim in Dvarim. Actually, forces that play a significant role in the Sefer Shmuel altogether. One of the most important components of this soothsaying that is prohibited is Ov. Ov is a kind of mediation with the souls of the dead. Who is responsible for eradicating all of the Ov culture in the land of Canaan? Excuse me? Shaul.
Didn't one of them go to the Machshefa of Ein Dor and she contacts
Eshet Ov, right? Yes. Who is that?
Wasn't it Shaul?
Shaul. So after he finished eradicating and destroying and killing all of the oaths, because the Torah says it's prohibited, found himself at the end of his life in need of a necromancer to converse with Shmuel, and so he goes to Eshet Ov. Correct. That's exactly what happens. That's the story. That's the story that plays itself out in Sefer Shmuel. Take a look at Perek Dvarim, Perek Yudchet, starting with Pasuk Tet. Dvarim Perek Yudchet, Pasuk Tet. Starting Pasuk Tet, Ki Ata Ba La'aretz Asher Hashem Elokecha Noten Lach, as you come into the land of Israel, that God shall give you, Lo Tilmad La'asot Ketu Avot HaGoyim. Don't learn from the culture, idolatrous culture of the Gentile nations in that are indigenous to the land. Lo yimatzevecha ma'avir b'no b'to ba'esh. You may not allow amongst you, it shall not be found amongst you, those who take their children through the fires of Molech, the god of Ammon. Ammon, Moab, I never remember which one's which. Kosem Ksamim. Kosem is a magician, a soothsayer, or a magician in this case. Me'onen u'menachesh u'mechashef. All kinds of different activities related to soothsaying and necromancing and speaking to the dead. Menachesh is, it comes from the modern word l'nachesh, means to guess, comes from the same root. There is
to predict
based on, if you remember the story by Yosef, when he's disguised as the viceroy of Egypt, and he says to his brothers, "Don't trick me, ki nichashti, because I have the power of nichush. I can figure it out. Right? I have ki nichashti." The whole story with the Gavia, is part of that play on the context of the Nechesh. The Mechashef is a magician or witch of some craft of some kind. Chover Chaver, Eshet Chaver, that was the context of the story of Shaul. Vishoel Ov Vidoni, Shoel Ov is the one who looks to the dead, to speak to the dead, Vidoni, Vidoresh Alametim. All of these are Kito Avat Hashem Kol Ose Ele, Beglala Tovot Ele Hashem El Kecha Marisha Tami Panecha. These are all activities that the Canaanites were stooped in, that God prohibits, doesn't want, expelling them from this land because of it. Tamin Tiyem Hashem Elokecha, you need to be wholehearted and devoted solely to God, and therefore, these nations, when they want to turn to powers, who do they turn to? Magicians, Ma'onanim and Kosmim. Whereas you want to understand what's going on in the world, you want to turn to a spiritual force, to whom do you turn to? But rather, Navi mikirbecha achecha kamoni akim lecha Hashem elokecha elav tishmaun. You don't need all this garbage because you have Navi. You have a Navi. You have prophets. And the whole context of the Nevuah of a Navi is diametrically opposed to all of these kinds of soothsaying forces in the world and magic in the world. What does this bring us back to? Take a look at the source, at source 4. At one point or another, when Shmuel finally challenges Shaul in the aftermath of the failed attack on Amalek, and he says, I brought back all of these animals from Amalek in order to bring sacrifices to God, Shmuel challenges Shaul, and he says to him, Vayomer Shmuel, in source 4, Ha chafetz, Hashem ba'olot uzvachim kishmo b'kol Hashem. Does God want sacrifices and offerings more than he desires loyalty to his word? Hinei shmoa mizevach tov. Heeding his word is better than sacrifices. Le'akshiv mechelev elim. Listening is better, more important than the fat of animals. Ki chatat kesem, Mary, the sin of kesem, the sin of magic, of soothsaying, of this kind of activity is rebellion, Mary. Va'aven utrafim hafzer, yan ma'astet va'ashem v'yimazcham melech. What's aven utrafim?
Divinations and soothsayers or whatever.
Right. So suddenly we have a whole different context to the phrase Ben Oni. Not Ben Oni in the context of my Onen or Aninut, but rather Ben Oni in the context of the son of my Aven. What was her Aven? That she perceived this child, this story, her death, to be associated with. It's not an accident that more than once the word Aven is associated with Trefim. Specifically Trefim. Ki Avon, the Aven utrafim hafzer. Ki atrafim dibru Aven. When she turns to at her death and she names her child Ben Oni and she or Ben Aven, right? The grammatical form of Ben, if you took Aven and put the shali ending to it, you would end up turning this vowel into the consonant into a vowel. Ben Oni would come from the root Aven. What's the issue? Right. What's at stake in this story is the story of the Trefim. Not an accident that Rashi links, and the Medrash links, her death to the stealing of the Trefim from Yaakov, from Lavan. Rashi links it to the oath that Yaakov had taken saying anyone who took your trafim should die. It's a kind of a plitat peh, it's a kind of a slip of the tongue. However, Rashi notwithstanding, I'm not sure that that's necessarily the whole picture. Let's go back one step and raise the question, why she took the trafim in the first place. That's machloket rishonim. And Rashi, consistent with his own position, suggests that the only reason she took these trafim, right, says Rashi, to
prevent them from being used.
To prevent them from being used, right, to stop her father from using them. So take a look at source 6. Actually, let's first look at the psukim. Psukim paraglamet aleph. Go back a little bit to paraglamet aleph and Bereishit. Starting with Pasuk Yud Tet. When Yud Chet, as they're leaving, Vayinhaget kol mikneh vet kol uchosho asher achash mikneh kinyano asher achash bepadan aram lavo Yitzchak aviv arta kanan. Yaakov took all, after he got the agreement of his wives to leave, takes all of his cattle and all of his possessions, takes it over the hills if he's ready, as if he's shepherding them. V'levan alach l'gzozo tzono, went to shear his sheep, Lavan. Vatignov Rachel et atrafim asher lavia. Rachel stole the trafim that belonged to her father. Vayignov Yaakov et lev Lavana arami al bali yigid lo kivorechu. Yaakov stole the heart of Lavan by leaving without telling her Lavan. So it's an interesting play on words. Both Yaakov and Rachel are guilty of, or being accused of, stealing. Rachel stole the trafim. Yaakov stole the heart of Lavan. That kind of play on words is not an accident. Vatignov Rachel et atrafim, vayignov Yaakov et lev Lavan arami. Then a little bit later, as Lavan catches up to Yaakov. Pasuk Lamed Bet. Im asher timtzat Elohecha lo yichyeh, declares to Lavan, anybody, if your gods are found anywhere here, that person shall not live. Neged achenu akerna mayim adi v'kach lecha v'lo yada Yaakov ki Rachel ganavata. Yaakov didn't know that Rachel had stolen him. And then it comes to search the tent of Rachel, v'Rachel lakchat atrafim v'tesimem b'kad hagamah v'teshev alayhem. Rachel had removed them from the tent and hid them. So Rashi understood the significance of these activities of Rachel as a function of her effort to do what? Why would she have stolen the trafim?
Prevent her father from using
them. But that's actually not what Rashi says. What Rashi actually says is lafrish et avod et avia me avodah zara nitkavna. What did she really want to do?
Prevent him or stop him from being an idol.
Stop him from doing idolatry. In other words, what she really wanted to do, says Rashi, is to make him do tshuva. Lafrish avia me avodah zara. So how do you do that? How do you be mafrish your father from avodah zara? You hide all the cigarettes in the house, right? You take the Avodah Zarah and you steal them, correct? To which Yabai Brunel asks a remarkably difficult question, which is, first of all, besides the fact that she had all these years to try to convince her father to abandon the Avodah Zarah, why choose this moment when they're leaving? But besides that, maybe it was an opportunity. Right? But besides that, Yabai Brunel asks one of those, like, bombastic, in your face, right between the eyes questions. If her agenda was to get her father to stop using Avodah Zarah, why did she take them with? Why didn't she just destroy them? Pieces of stone. How hard is it to break? Smash them. Bury them. Get rid of them. If all you want to do is prevent your father from you, even if, and here's the remarkable piece of it. Let's assume for the moment the issue is even to prevent a father not to try to get a father to do tshuva, but maybe even just to prevent your father from using them. Maybe they, think that he'll catch up to them. You know, that's already jumping ahead of it. Let's take a look at the Rishon. So that's Rashi. Rashi says, "Vategnov v'achel tafim lafish aviyam mi'avodah zarah." Take a look at the Rashbam. Says the Rashbam, "Vategnov v'achel tafim." Why did she steal the tafim? "Shelo yagidu v'yodiu lelavan ki rotzei Yaakov livroach." Says Rashbam, these two psukim are juxtaposed to each other. She stole the trefim, Yaakov stole Lavan's heart. Meaning, Yaakov's trying to escape in stealth. Rachel, says the Rashbam, knows that Lavan has a secret weapon. And that in order to enable Yaakov's plan of escaping in stealth to succeed, she needs to take care of something that Yaakov could never have dreamt of or imagined. Namely, that Lavan has a source of information that Yaakov is unaware of. So therefore, shelo yagidu v'yodiu lelavan ki rotzei Yaakov livrach. Yaakov wants to run away. If she leaves the trefim, Lavan is going to know everything that goes on. So therefore, she needs to take the trefim. Ki inyan she'ne'emar en efod utrefim. Ki atrefim dibru aven. Regilimayu liksombahem. That was part of their tradition. It was normal for them to use these trefim as a kind of soothsaying apparatus. So if suddenly Yaakov disappears, Yaakov wants to escape in the middle of the night, you've got to plug the intelligence hole. Where's the intelligence hole? The trefim. So she took them.
But again, why didn't she just destroy them?
Again, why doesn't she just destroy them is a valid question.
They're unexpectedly running away. So she didn't think out exactly how we could work
fair.
This out.
Fair. Okay. Out fair. Doc, similarly.
The whole assumption is that there's actually something to these trefim.
Oh, that's the question we're going to come to. That is exactly the question we have to come to. That is the question that we need to come to. Ultimately, what's driving her, and that's why Rashi didn't want to get into any of this, because the moment you assume that she stole the trefim to prevent Yaakov, to prevent Lavan, from somehow guessing that they escaped, or in the language of the Radak, the Radak makes it even clearer. He says, "Vaya makom rachok shloshet yamim." Right, they were going on a 3-day journey, or they were going for, it was 3 days before Yaakov Lavan discovered what they were doing, and this distance that they had separated themselves was a 3 days journey. Lefichach, in the last line, lakcha Rachel et hatrafim, ki lo haya adam bebayit sheyim na'ana. Right, there was nobody there to stop her because there was a way. Vatrafim hem klei anachoshet or nichush shiroim bo sha'ot hayom. It's this kind of device that you use to
tell the time.
Ve'yu'u bo et hatidot. And you'd use it to tell the future. Now, sometimes it would disappoint. Sometimes they disappointed. Why are they in the plural? They were made out of pieces. Avram ben Ezra katav ki atrafim asum al tzurot shel ben adam al tzurat ben adam. That this is a kind of an idol or like a little form of a human being, a form of a person, and is designed to receive some sort of powers from above. Uganava otam Rachel. Why did she steal them? So that her father couldn't figure out where they went. Yaakov lo yada b'zeh davar, כמו שאמר, ולא ידע יעקב, כי אם היה ידוע, יודע, לא היה מניח אותם לקחת מבית אבי, הדבר שלא מדעתו. If Yaakov had known, he would never have let her take them, take anything from her father's house without her father's knowledge. Why does it describe having taken them without her father's knowledge? Besides the rest of the story, because it says, Vatignov, she stole them. So if Yaakov had known, clearly he would not have let her steal anything from her father's house. Kol sheken tefachim. Not nice to steal, let alone steal idols. But you get the impression from all of this that
she believed that they had
that she believed that they had power. It's exactly where Rashi doesn't go there, because the remarkable piece of this is that if she really took them because she didn't want her father to use them, that means that in some level she was concerned that they may give them away. Mm-hmm. So you could argue maybe she was trying to hedge her bets, not take chances, right? So just to add one
she
more,
grew up with that mentality,
right?
Too.
So now one more piece to the puzzle.
But didn't they really have some powers?
So there's a major machloket Rishonim, Ramban and the Rambam, as to whether or not some of these things were actually had some sort of legitimacy that the Torah prohibited, or whether it was all a farce and the Torah prohibited engaging in the farce. It's a major machloket in the Rishonim. The Rambam, the Ramban, the Sajigon, the Dak, they all get involved in this. It's a very heated machloket. We'll see it by the story of, we'll get to it, not this year, but eventually we'll get to the story of Eshetov by Shaul, and we'll see in the Radak. Radak goes to town on this issue. So whether or not there was real power to these conjurers. The vast majority of opinions today are of a consensus that they were absolute falsehoods.
The Radak puts it as something being astrological tables and charts and devices for calculating. Wouldn't put them as being magic. That's still scientific, from as scientific as it would have been at that point.
Right, but the Ramban says no, that there was real power to these things and that they were prohibited because they had real power. And the Rambam says that if you make such an assertion, you're a heretic. And it's a whole discussion back and forth. I mean, they didn't mince their words over this issue. But in all cases, the question of whether she believed in them is a remarkable statement. Because it's clearly a Avodah Zarah.
That's what I'm going to do. But that's looking at, it's not necessarily a Avodah Zarah. I mean, Lavan clearly calls him Elohai.
Right.
Lavan clearly tilts.
Right. And just to go one more piece, and that's Source 9, which I quote. I actually didn't have this one on in the database, so I typed this one out. So I hope that I typed it correctly. I apologize if there's a typo here. Verachel Gnevatam. Yeah. Shadal. Shmuel David Lutzato. Was a. Shmuel David Lutzato? What? Shmuel David Lutzato. Yeah.
That's not the
Ramchal.
No.
It's many generations descended.
Yeah. I think it's a. Mm-hmm. I think the Shadal is what, 19th century, right?
Late 20th.
So just to clarify the question, he's of the opinion that she stole them because she believed in them. Clearly she wasn't idolatrous. Sof sof lo ayu ela ke'en goral. They were like dice. They were like lots. They are otok kli murkav michalakim rabim. They were in fact made up of many pieces. That's why they're called in the plural trefim. Vayu ashomim minanim otam bedrachim yeduim. Those who used them, right? Those who they would shake them or throw them in some way that was known. Ulefi mashe yotze b'mikre. Ayedei ananua. As whatever the sticks, however they fell, however the dice numbers came up.
In Africa.
Excuse me?
The witch doctors in
right.
Africa.
It's exactly.
They would literally throw bones.
That's exactly what it was.
They would tell your fortune from looking.
That is exactly what it is. If you had a video clip of that, that's what you would have with the trophy. Al yadeha na'anua, there's a nun missing. Hayu shoftim. Ki'el yishiv kach v'kach. They would answer, God has responded, so and so, such and such. V'inzu avodah zarah. This isn't technically avodah zarah. Ki'im lefi machshevet ha-shoel. It depends on the mentality of the person asking the question. Whether or not that this kind of activity falls in the category of avodah zarah or not depends on, it's interesting, not on the performer, but on the seeker. Right? What is the person, the shoel, the one who's, I mean, shoel here means the person who's throwing the dice, throwing the lots, and responding. What is the responding to? Imu ma'amin sha'tshuva ba lo me'alim lo me'el yachid. Does he really believe that the answer is coming from gods, or does he really, or does he believe that somehow this is related to the luck of the draw, the mazel, the goral? Right? They also use the goral in halacha, and the goral lazazel, the goral by the divided land of Israel. Ultimately, if you used the goral, what was the difference? You believed that the goral had a message from a Kadosh Baruch Hu. Here, ultimately, it depends on what you believed. But what his point was that these trafim, she stole them partially because she doesn't want her father to use them, and partly, it would seem, because she wanted to use them. Now, if that's the case,
where do you see that she wanted to use them?
So that's the question in all of this, Rachel gnavatam ki amina behem. Meaning, so that's the Barbanel's question. Why did she take them with? Why doesn't she just get rid of them? Right, they're escaping. They're running away. Why doesn't she just dump them? Right, smash them. Unless you want to say that somehow she valued these trophies. She hides them from Yaakov. She implies into their existence, let's put it this way, whether she wants to actually use them or not, I couldn't tell you, but she certainly valued them and implied in their existence a power that is very dangerous.
But he said that she did not, that she was not related to Bodhisattva, this guy.
Right.
So then she probably wouldn't want to use them. But I think that if you said that she just, in the spur of the moment, she just went in and grabbed him and said, what do I do with them? I'll just hide them underneath. I'll just sit on them.
Valuable that you could sell them on the market, on eBay later.
Isn't that tied to what she called her son? Because she called him then on and we were talking about.
We're going to come back to that in a second.
Okay.
That's exactly right. You know, it's when she dies in childbirth.
She feels guilty.
So Rashi connects it to Yaakov's oath. I'm dying because of the trafim. What does it mean I'm dying because of the trafim? Ben oni, ben ha'aven, ben ha'trafim. And calling this child ben aven or ben oni is the equivalent of calling him ben ha'trafim. So what does she mean by that? So Rashi says she means by that, Yaakov, it said, anybody who has these trafim should die. If she dies, clearly it's all Yaakov's fault. Which doesn't make any sense.
He might not have known that either.
I mean, he said it publicly. But that's what Rashi...
It's a punishment for taking them?
No, Rashi understood that it's a punishment, not a punishment for taking them, but that it was a response... No, neither. That to Rashi's consistent pattern, it's because Yaakov cursed her. So she suffers. Ben Tsari, I'm suffering innocently. I'm suffering for no reason. I'm suffering because my husband declared this kind of plitat ben, opened up his mouth and said that I should die. Which is very complicated. Whereas, so I suggested that there's another possibility, which is that she's not looking at this from the perspective of Yaakov's, right? Plitat ben, Yaakov's slip of the tongue, but rather as a kind of remorse over her own iniquity of having taken these trophies. Where does she do tshuva? That she believed in them, that she valued them, that she put credence into them. So much so that there's even a medrash, and I actually haven't seen this, but I saw it quoted by Menachem Kasher in his Torah Shleima. There's even a medrash that suggests that at one point she gives them back to Yaakov. What does she own up to having taken them and giving them back to Yaakov? So after they leave Beit El, there's a remarkable brief conversation that is astounding. Take a look in Paraklamet Hay. They're actually before they leave Beit El, as they're going down to Beit El. Paraklamet Hay. Vayomer Elokim al Yaakov. They're in Shechem. Hashem says to Yaakov, Kuma le Beit El. Go back to beginning of Paraklamet Hay, just the next parak. Kuma le, beginning of this parak, actually. Right, this is right. No, we were in Lamed Aleph, now we're back in Lamed Hay. Vayomer Elokim al Yaakov, Kum ale Beit El, v'shev sham. Go back to Beit El. He was in Shechem till now, after the story with Lavan, after the story with Dinah. God comes to him and he says, now go back to Beit El. V'aseh shem mizbeach le'el anirai lecha bevorchacha mipnei asavechicha. Go back and build the mizbeach you promised. Now look at Pasuk Bet. Vayomer Yaakov el Beito ve'el kol asher imo. Yaakov turns to his household and he says, Hasidu et Elohe HaNechar Asher B'tochachem. Remove the idolatry in your midst. Vitaru v'achlifu simlatechem. Cleanse yourself, purify yourself, go to the mikvah. V'nakuma v'nale betel. To whom is he talking and what was he referring to? So, Menachem Kasher quotes a medrash. I haven't seen this in the database, but I saw it in Torah Shlema. And the word Hasiru, which is written without a yud, the medrash says Chaser yud limed she lo hayu shar nashav chashudim bekach. He didn't suspect anybody of having idolatry except one person. Sulati Rachel al torfei Lavan. And the suspicion was that at this moment, and that's exactly what they do. They hand over the idolatry. Who's the they? It's not reasonable, it's not possible to assume that Yaakov comes into the land of Israel with his family with these trafim in Rachel's camel or in her tent. What happened to these trafim? What happened to them? So what's the assumption?
Yaakov disposed of them.
Yaakov got rid of them. At some point or another, she had to confess to having them. She hands them over to Yaakov. And then they can continue in their journey. In the meantime, the next story is she dies in childbirth and she names his child Ben Oni, Ben Aven, Ben Atrafim. And Yaakov reverses it. Yaakov says, no, it's not your problem. It's not your fault. Right? It's Benjamin. And then there's all discussion what Benjamin means. But that dispute is as to whether or not she does tshuva, whether or not he is responsible for her death. Then there's a whole conversation as to what caused her death, whether it was her iniquity or his remorse, if you will. Benjamin, I suggested to you once, it comes from the word yamin, as in an oath that you take with your right hand. And that he was reflecting that oath that he took and that say, blaming himself for her death. Well, she blamed herself for her death, not because of Yaakov's oath, but because of the iniquity of having taken these trafim, and in a sense, having imbued these trafim with more spiritual value than they were ostensibly worth or valued. So I come back to the story, the epilogue of the end of the story of the capture of the Aron and the death of Eshet Pinchas, which the Navi describes to us in phraseology that is so dramatically parallel to the death of Rachel and the birth of Binyamin. And ultimately the two episodes of these two deaths, both associated with, in addition to all the other parallels, both associated with the taking of an object from its rightful place.
Yeah, but in a one sense, that Rachel actually was the one who took it. In this sense, Aisha's...
Correct.
She didn't really have anything to do with that.
Correct. And that observation is pointed out, or that distinction. But if you think about the focus of both stories, the focus of both stories is on the Trefim on the one hand, which she imbues with more power, more significance, more spiritual significance than they really were worth, and ultimately, therefore, dies and names his child Ben Oni, Ben Aven, Ben Trefim. And Eshet Pinchas, who as she's dying is reflecting upon the tragedy, in this case not a personal tragedy, but a national tragedy, of the capture of the Aron. The Aron was also taken from its rightful place and put into the center of the battle. Why?
Because also too much emphasis was placed on the Aron.
Because they too misplaced the emphasis. And to their minds, what were they taking into battle? They weren't taking into battle the box containing the Luchos because the Shekhinah was in the box. What were they taking into battle? What did they want to bring into the battle with them?
These two idols.
The Kruvim.
Right.
That's the issue. Galak Kavod Yisrael is the function of the Kruvim. And the irony, the tragedy of it, is that this Ikavod, who's named because of the capture of the Aron and the imbuing of the Avodah Zarah into the object of the Kruvim, in contrast to Rachel's death and her attempt to name this child, Ben Oni, Ben Trefim, for having imbued these physical objects, in this case also the plural of them, with a kind of divine source or divine power that was unnecessary. So I think that ultimately is, in a sense, what the purpose of this contract, of this parallel is about. It teaches us as much about Rachel and about the Trefim and her having imbued these Trefim with more significance than they warranted, in the same way that the people had imbued the Kruvim with more significance and more religious significance than they warranted as well. And therefore these two stories point us in the same direction. So that was the postscript to the story of Eshet Pinchas, the epilogue of Perek Dalet. I know I had meant to do a to begin our journey into Perek Hay, but I did not want to let this go. So we will adjourn here, and what we will.